Sugatsia for my friends at Casper. Years of research, hundreds of tests, thousands of iterations. The result? The latest and dreamiest in sleep innovation, including the new mattresses from Casper. Casper has done it again with all new mattresses. Waking up with back pain? Introducing Zone Support, Casper's unique ergonomic system designed to keep your spine aligned when you sleep. There's something brand new called Airscape, engineered foam layers with perforations that help regulate your sleep temperature. From bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything to build the dream bedroom for every kind of sleeper. I've been sleeping on a Casper mattress for years. I swear by it. Most comfortable mattress I've ever slept on. Anytime they have new innovations, I am in on that. And as always, free shipping and free returns. And now Casper is offering free contactless delivery. And as always, free returns. Go to Casper.com. Use code Lebatard for $100 off your mattress order. That's code Lebatard for $100 off your mattress order. Terms and conditions apply. See Casper.com/terms.
If you've listened to the last couple of weeks here on the Local Hour, we've been doing a cool thing with Amin El-Hassan, two episodes in now. This is the third episode of Amin sort of giving an oral history of his time with the Phoenix Suns and in the NBA. Many of you know Amin as a part of our show as an NBA front office insider. You can see his work on The Jump, but he has a credibility when he goes on those shows, and this is a story of how Amin got that credibility. When last we spoke, we went over Amari Sotomayor and Boris Diaw coming off of the bench and the Suns losing another heartbreaker in the playoffs to the San Antonio Spurs. We started tackling the offseason and how they revamped that roster, looking at names like Grant Hill and inevitably the trademark Steve Kerr trade during his time as a Phoenix Suns general manager, bringing in Shaquille O'Neal from the Miami Heat in exchange for Sean Marion. Over that last episode, you said you had a pretty good idea that Grant Hill was coming. Was this a tampering issue, and how prevalent is that? Because you seem to have a pretty good idea of how things were breaking through back channeling.
Yeah, I personally didn't have any evidence or proof or like transcripts or logs or whatever. But I know that early in that year, so free agency started July 1, at least January, if not earlier than that, when we would write our projected starting lineup for the next season as we're planning, Grant Hill was always a starting small forward every single time. And I remember asking, how do we know? And they was just kind of like, he's going to be a starting small forward. That was the extent of the conversation that they had with me about that. The only other time I remember something like that in my career where it was like something that was going to happen was when I was with the Knicks, during the 2004-05 season, we knew Eddie Curry was going to be a Knick the next year.
Hmm. This is just agents sort of talking to general managers, assume?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I think like in the case of Grant, you know, you got to understand because our training staff was so good and had such a great reputation, like, the reclamation projects were Antonio McDyess. Everyone said his career was going to be over. Comes to Phoenix for half a season, traded from New York. At the end of it, signs like a $40 million deal in Detroit. Like Detroit and then San Antonio after that. Steve Nash, Mark Cuban famously. I'm not going to match on what was less than max by a good deal. I think Nash's deal was about $13 million a year that he signed with the Suns. Cuban's like, I'm not going to match on that. Guy's like a multi-time all-star, best friends with Dirk, all that stuff. I'm not going to. His back's not going to hold up. Guy goes on to win two MVPs. Mm-hmm. Amari Stoudemire, obviously everyone was like, oh my God, this guy's knees are all exploded, whatever. Comes back, first team All-NBA. So there were a bunch of examples of these people who came to Phoenix, were broken down, and then like, it's a miracle. So Grant, I think, was very attracted to the idea that everyone said his career was over and here the guys are going to be able to save me.
And Grant's a great culture guy too. Absolute professional. So he fit right in with that team. Was there anybody not fitting in? Because you guys obviously come to the decision to move Sean Marion. Was that contract related or was there more to just simply the contract he was seeking?
I would say it was mostly contractual, right? Sean obviously was a tremendous player. And, you know, he has or had a propensity to kind of, why don't I get enough credit? Which is true. He, like, publicly, people did not give Sean Marion enough credit. He was kind of seen as just like this glorified energy guy, when in fact he was a remarkable, versatile defensive player who one night we would put him on Tony Parker, the next night we put him on Yao. And he guarded all those and everything in between. And he didn't really get the due he got, at least not publicly. I know we valued him. But for Sean, I think that was a source of frustration for him. And at some point, that's all he could focus on. And his agent, God rest his soul, Dan Fagan, did a pretty good job of tweaking that paranoia in Sean and using it as an excuse to kind of say, we're going to get the maximum. Because Fagan's reputation was, look, I'm not a cuddly agent. I'm not like the Goodwins who I care about your every part of your life and your development as a human being. Fagan's thing was, I get you top dollar. And so Fagan's mission was always, Sean's got to get a max contract. Sean's not paid enough. Sean was getting paid max and was the highest paid player on our team. But Fagan put it in Sean's mind that he was undervalued. And so it was a source of consternation. And at some point, it just wears on people, right? You just don't, even if you're right, people don't want to hear about it anymore, especially when there's nothing we can actually do about it.
But how does that materialize? Does it materialize in the locker room? Does it materialize with Sean Marion's interactions with you guys in the front office? Does that get to a point where you're like, oh, this is just not a fit anymore?
Well, it's again, publicly in the media, griping all the time, privately griping about touches and shots and, you know, in the locker room and stuff like that. And, you know, just, and again, it wasn't anything overt or really like, you know, the hell with this place. Da, 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 da. And I want to stress, I don't want to paint Sean Marion to be a bad guy. It's just at some point, especially when, you know, the only thing that's going to make him happy is another max deal. And we knew math wise that wasn't going to happen. Because Amari's extension was about to kick in and, you know, we were already luxury taxpayers. So we knew, like, at what he was getting paid, palatable, if he was going to get like another massive bump, that might break us, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other part of it was Marcus Banks. Marcus Banks had a deal of, which was mid-level, but again, for a luxury taxpaying team, that was a hefty deal for a guy who didn't play for us. And so the feeling there was, part of it is, a lot of it was financial. We got to get rid of all this money. Like, we got to clear this money up. And the other part of it was, you know, the frustrations. And then the final part of it was San Antonio beat us up. Like, we were, I remember running the analytics on this. We were an excellent first stop defense, meaning we play a possession, da da da, they run their stuff, they take a shot. We're excellent at that. But then a lot of times teams just grab the rebound and lay it back up. Mm-hmm. And so if you look up our, again, when you look at your defensive rating, well, what da da da, like, well, is that just because we don't guard anybody or because someone grabs a rebound and dunks it because we're small and undersized, especially when you're talking about Tim Duncan,
yeah,
and the Spurs.
And so we're seeing the seeds of how you guys come to the decision of, yeah, Shaquille O'Neal. This is interesting because you mentioned Marcus Banks and Sean Marion and you have a problem there. And this trade with Miami is very much trading one set of problems for another set of, mm-hmm, problems. For the Miami audience, it's a pretty well-documented thing that Shaquille O'Neal was doing all the Shaq things behind the scenes, mm-hmm, that he's sort of reputed to do, publicly flirting with Mark Cuban to sort of come get him. And then the Phoenix Suns trade sort of surprises everybody because here's this fast, up-tempo, revolutionary, attacking offense of Mike D'Antoni. And how does fat old Shaq fit into this? But you guys are having discussions. You clearly know you need someone to help with your second chance points problems. You need someone to battle in there with Tim Duncan and Shaq, one of Tim Duncan's greatest rivals on the inside. Was Shaq the first choice? Who else did you identify as bringing in and maybe changing some things up?
No, it wasn't about, we need to go get a center and trade Sean Marion for a center. It was about, that conversation started between Mickey Arison and Robert Sarver. That I guess they were just like complaining, complaining about their problems. And then they kind of looked at each other like, throw mama from the train, like, what, uh-huh, crisscross applesauce, right? So that conversation trickled down to us, like, hey, the Heat would be interested. And for, and part of it is like, we've been shopping Sean and Marcus all over the league, and there wasn't a lot of, interest.
Yeah.
Part
things unraveled for that market after the KG thing. Why?
Well, from Marcus's standpoint, his contract was just too onerous for a guy, again, who at that point wasn't a rotation player. From Sean's standpoint, him and Fagan were very, very adamant that, man, if you try to trade us somewhere that we're not having it, then like we'll do whatever our power to tank it, right? That Fagan's thing was, we'll tank this thing. Cause Sean had a knee condition that nobody ever knew about. Didn't bother him. Didn't affect him one bit. You saw his career, never really had knee issues. But if Sean were to say, oh, I got a pain right here, and you did an MRI, it was like, oh my God. And he would fail a physical.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
So Fagan kind of used that as a kind of, don't send us no bullshit. Don't send us anywhere kind of crazy. And so the Boston one was actually a place where they approved because Sean and Danny Ainge had a relationship, and Danny loved Sean Marion. But Fagan was adamant about the money, right? Or we'll opt out. And the difference in this case is that Miami was like, we'll see how it goes. We're willing to take that risk. And obviously Miami was a place that Sean was like, oh, cool. I wouldn't mind playing there. So,
yeah. And from a Miami standpoint, that Sean Marion is really the seeds
yes.
of them yes. beginning to clear the books for what eventually became the big three.
That's exactly what that was all about. So like from Miami's standpoint, that threat meant nothing because they were, you want to talk about people knowing things years in advance. They were starting to get ready for the big three to come in. From our standpoint, our luxury tax bill went down because the combination of Sean and Marcus was more than what Shaq was making on his own.
All right. Interesting. So this trade starts being discussed behind the scenes between owners, and then it eventually trickles down to the front office. Is the front office in Phoenix like, Shaq, how does that guy fit?
We did a lot of work. We did a lot of work for every department. Myself from analytics and video, and then our training staff. I'll never forget this. Aaron Nelson, our head athletic trainer, who's now, with the Pelicans. I think he's got a VP role with the Pelicans. But I remember Aaron watched like 15 minutes of Shaq film. And I'm like, yeah, he's fine. And remember, you remember this. Everyone said Shaq's career is over. This is it. It's the end of a long and illustrious career. He can't even get on the floor, da, da, da. And Aaron, like, oh, he's fine. I'm like, what? He's like, yeah. His such and such isn't firing right. And because of that, he's like, compensating by doing this, da, 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 da. Get him in here in 2 weeks. He'll be fine.
So you were looking at it strictly from physical problems, and Shaq did have some physical problems, and he was publicly beefing with the Miami Heat training staff, and you guys have what is reputed to be the best training staff mm-hmm. in Phoenix. But also, do you guys sort of address a lot of what's going on with Shaq? It's just he's not motivated, and he's acting out on the court, too?
Yes, yes, because when our intel was strong on that. Like, Shaq felt like, you know, a couple years removed from a championship, now he's forgotten, and not only forgotten, but it's like all you guys are fawning over the Golden Boy, right? Mm-hmm. Wait a second. The Golden Boy didn't win you the championship, even though he won finals MVP. Like, the Diesel is the one that won the championship. So
have a little self-awareness there, Shaq. You weren't even the best center on Miami in those finals, but okay.
In those finals, but like, you gotta understand, there's 2 years of stuff that happened leading up to the finals.
Oh, understood. And Avery Johnson wouldn't refuse to stop double teaming him.
Yeah. And that, by the way, has value. That has mm-hmm. value. Like, if I would have talked about this with Steph Curry a million times, he can take zero shots and be the best player on the floor because the whole defense rearranged itself just because he's there.
Yeah. This is actually some insight from NBA 2K. It's actually great analysis. He spreads the floor in ways that no one has ever spread the floor in the history of the NBA, Steph Curry.
Ethan Strauss wrote about this during the second MVP season, which is the only comp to Curry is Shaq. That's the only player that draws that much attention from everybody on the floor, no matter what's happening. Just him being there makes a difference. So, you know, we knew that part. We knew he wasn't done for. We knew like, oh, this guy is just, he hasn't been properly taken care of. And we knew that, he would help us with post defense and rebounding, which were our two biggest kind of holes.
I remember looking at this trade and just feeling like this is just such a weird fit. Shaq with this team, it seems counterculture. was there any voice in that front office that was like totally against this whole Shaq thing?
No, I mean, because you're looking at it like we were like, get me Shaq. Mm-hmm. And that's not the
it was get rid of Merriam.
It was get like clean up this stuff right here. If this is the best that we can do, is this workable? Can we make this work? The answer is no, then we look somewhere else. If the answer is yes, then all right, let's do it. You know, and there's a revisionist history where people are like now saying that Mike was furious. He didn't want that. Mike was on board, man. Everybody was on board because we were just so worn down by Sean and his, you know, and Dan Fagan, really. I keep putting this on Sean. It's really Dan Fagan. If Sean had a different agent, things would have gone different.
Okay.
But also worn down by getting beat by the same team over and over again, like the same way over and over again.
Yeah, you gotta make a change. And was Steve Nash aboard this whole Shaq thing too? Did you guys even approach Steve Nash this?
Yes. And I think at the time everyone kind of was on board. No, again, I want to stress, nobody was sitting here thinking like, oh man, Shaq is, you kidding? We can get Shaq. It was more like Shaq can come here. All right. Let's give it a try. Because, you know, all the factors that I just named. So, you know, and again, like that was off of the medical, off of video, off of analytics showing like how he was going to help us in these areas. And so he comes over and, I'll never forget. He came over that first night at midnight and I went to the gym and we do the workout, like just to get him kind of loose and stuff like that. And we ran through pick and rolls and I was the guard that was guarding the ball and I ran into a Shaq screen and that was the first time I realized, you know, there's another level of like,
like power.
It wasn't even power. He didn't move. It like you ever run into something unexpectedly and your neck crick?
Yeah.
You hear it.
You have whiplash.
Yes, that's exactly what happened to me. And so then it was like, then they wanted me to throw alley-oops to him and I kept throwing and it was too low. And they just said, just throw it to the shot clock. And he catch and dunk. And I was like, this is just insane. Like, I've never thrown.
And this is an older Shaq.
Yeah. And this older Shaq that's not in shape, right? So 2 weeks, he's back on the court. Literally, it took 2 weeks. And when he came to us, he was really kind of like, again, he came in. I think part of him thought his career was over because he just didn't feel the same on the court. 2 weeks later, he's on the court. And his whole demeanor is, I'm here to help these guys win. I've had my time. Now it's time to get a ring and call Amari the best power forward in the league. And Steve Nash, the best passer I've ever played with. And
oh my God.
Said all the right things.
This is so Shaq. This is so Shaq in a new place.
We went,
and I believe he like dove into the sands like very early on too.
Every home games. Home games. Cause his whole thing was like, he explained it. It was like, yo, it gets the people going, right? Before that was even a quote. Like he was the one that said, oh, it gets the people going. He wouldn't do it on the road, but at home he'd do it. And the other thing that happened was we went from, I believe, second worst defensive rebounding team in the NBA to number one.
Wow.
We went from, like bottom third in points in the paint to top third. Like, all the things that we wanted him to help us with, he helped us with. And he didn't complain about touches. He said, I'm here to be Bill Russell. And like he was a good camper and we won. We went, 21-10, something like that over the end of the season. So it worked for us in the context of him buying into that role and doing those things. Now the unintended consequence was we became terrible guarding the pick and roll because Shaq didn't want to come up. He wanted to sag on everything. And so guys like Tony Parker and those guys, what they would do is they would come off the screen and then they would snake dribble back, like snake right back into that soft spot right there and take the little mid-range shot. And Shaq would never come up to greet them. So, or if there was a pick and pop, he would not go out and recover. And so that was our new kind of weakness.
All right. So this is a sort of mid-season acquisition. It's going well. You guys get into the postseason. Who do you draw and how does this work out for Phoenix?
So it was one of those things where the last day of the season, there were like seven games that were going to determine the standings. Like you and we could either finish as high as three or as low as seven. And so I'm a video guy. I did a monologue about this when I hosted the Jump a couple of years ago. That the last day of the season for many video guys is hell because you're getting ready for the playoff books, which is the most exhaustive scouting report, video, kind of like booklet and accompanying DVD that you make.
And you're preparing for four different matchups.
Because there's no, well, I kind of think we're going to play these guys. And then, you know, it turns out, no, you're playing these guys. You can't say, oh, give me a couple of days to get this thing together. So we're making these books as is because Thursday morning, because we're playing Wednesday, Thursday morning, this thing has to be ready. When the guys come in at 6 a.m., boom, here you go. So we work pretty much all night through that. And for us, it just fell to a point like we beat the team we were supposed to beat, which is Portland, but we ended up faced up a course against the San Antonio Spurs.
All right. How does this series go?
This is the series where game one is like a double overtime thriller and Duncan hits a three and is like screaming and like he's like Kevin Garnett out there. And we're like, that was, I remember sitting in the video room and saying, that ain't Tim Duncan, man. Not in what he was doing on the court, but just the amount of outward emotion he was showing.
What was going on there? The Shaq thing?
I don't know. I think they respected us. They knew that we were kind of the best bet to beat them every year. Mm-hmm. And so that game being so back and forth and us having our, you know, heavyweight shot and they give us their best on. And so that play, there were two plays. One play was at the end of regulation, they ran Michael Finley off Namari Stoudemire's screen, and he was guarded by Barbosa. It was a great play. They drew up a play, basically attacking two of our weaker defenders at the same time. And Finley hits a three to send it to overtime. And then when we get to overtime, they ran a pick and pop, and Roger was guarding the ball and had to fight, you know, over the screen because I think it was Ginobili, and Shaq was sagging. Uh-huh. And Ginobili threw the ball back to Duncan, who's never shot threes. Mm-hmm. Never shot threes, and he cut at the top of the 3-point line, and we're all, took the longest time ever. We're all looking at it. He's not going to shoot that. And Shaq never budged because again, it's Duncan. He's not going to shoot that. And he loads up and like, Jesus Christ. And he hit it. And that's the infamous like fist pump, Tim Duncan. And I remember in the timeout, it was one of those times where Pop wasn't talking. Tim Duncan was just screaming at everybody. And I'm like, Jesus Christ. And I didn't say this out loud, but internally, like, there's no fucking way we're going to win this series. Like when I saw Tim Duncan that fired up, I'm like, Jesus, man, like that, you just kind of know.
So does the air get let out of the balloon after you lose that dramatic game one?
Well, see, here's the funny thing. So game one was, I want to say Saturday afternoon, right? And through the quirks of NBA scheduling, game two was Wednesday night.
Oh no. So and you've got all that time to think about that.
We should have gone home. We should have flown home immediately Saturday. And for whatever reason, the decision was we're going to stay in San Antonio. And so we stayed in San Antonio for 3 days. I know I'm not supposed to curse, but 3 days, like lamenting off how almost could, would have, should have, all that stuff. And in the backdrop of all of this, Mike D'Antoni is maneuvering to go to New York.
Oh, wow.
And so now, like, we go out. Now, San Antonio is not a big town. You go to a restaurant, you're probably going to see someone you know. And so I remember going to dinner and seeing, like, Mike and Dan D'Antoni and Jack McCallum. And usually Mike's like, come on, guys, come in. I got you. Like, what are you guys having? And this time, I'm like, hey, guys. And then quiet conversation.
Yeah. Who's Jack McCallum?
The writer who wrote 7 Seconds or Less, the writer who wrote Dream Team. Like, he used to be a Sports Illustrated writer. Used to be a Sports Illustrated writer, but he's like one of the great basketball writers of all time, I would say. Because he wrote 7 Seconds or Less, him and Mike developed a friendship and like Mike confided in him. So there was that going on. There was another night when we went to dinner. It was me, Steve Kerr, and Griff, and Brent Barry was at the same restaurant. Brent Barry was another guy that we tried to sign and was supposed to come sign with us. And at the last second, he called us and said, I changed my mind. I'm going to San Antonio. And so we really felt like we got fucked over on that one.
I'm sure he has his regrets about how that went too.
You know what? I actually had a conversation with Brent Barry not too long ago, and he said, I wish I had come to you guys.
Yeah, no, no shit. We don't need to get into that one.
Oh, yeah. I thought you meant like from a championship standpoint.
I'm not meaning.
But
from
I think from a basketball standpoint, I think he wish he had come to us, even though they ended up winning. Well, no, they didn't even win. Yeah, they lost, so it doesn't matter. So I guess that's why. maybe that's why.
It never struck you as to why maybe he said that? Either way, we continue on. So you lose this series?
So, yeah, game two, same thing. It goes all the way to the end, and we lose a heartbreaker at game two. Come back to Phoenix. Game three, I think we were demoralized after losing two. Oh, by the way, the other thing I was going to say, Between game one and game two, one of the things I saw was I went and saw Forgetting Sarah Marshall at the theater. Great movie, funny movie.
Mm-hmm.
We lose game two in a heartbreaker. We go back to Phoenix. Game three, we get blown out. Blown out. We win game four, the pride game. Let's not, go out like suckers or whatever. Game five, we lose at the buzzer. Like on the last second play, I think Boris messed up an inbound or something like that. They won. And two things happened. One, Steve Nash got up and talked about how this, the little things, we're just as good as them. We're better than them, but they're great at the little things and we're not. And that's what we all need to work on. Everybody, right? And two, I never saw Forgetting Sarah Marshall again. Even though I knew it was a good movie, it's funny and everything, I can't watch it because it reminds me of those 3 days in San Antonio. And I don't want to think about those days.
All right. So we'll talk about where this leaves the Phoenix Sun franchise in the next episode, because you guys do finally get your revenge on the San Antonio Spurs. Yeah. Though it might be outside of what was your title window.
I'll say to you, to the listeners right now, we may not even get to that one next episode, because next episode we'll probably talk about the fall of Shaq and how you come within minutes of acquiring a future two-time MVP, including a unanimous MVP.
So, is this the Steph Curry thing?
This is the Steph Curry thing.
Oh, I can't
That's
wait.
That's a tease, ladies and gentlemen.
I can't wait for this episode. Yeah, because anytime it starts falling apart with Shaq physically, he'll bring the entire franchise down.
Oh, it wasn't falling apart physically. That's a super tease there.
What a tease for next week's episode. Amin El Hassan, thank you so much for covering the Shaq trade and those 3 nights in San Antonio. You should really give Forgetting Sarah Marshall another shot.
No, I know it was a good movie. I remember laughing my ass off in that theater on the Riverwalk, which is where everyone was. Again, someone
else.
It's
the only place to go.
Yeah.
Well, like, actually, no, just hop in the car and drive 90 minutes to Austin.
Yeah, no one's trying to do that, man.
I know a lot of people that worked for that Suns franchise that just lived in Austin and did the commute just because San Antonio is awful. It's everything that people say it is.
You know one guy who did that.
No, I know a couple.
I know a lot of guys. You know one.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's a hipster move. It's pretty on brand. All right, Amin, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks so much for taking the time out, and discussing your history with the Phoenix Suns.